Good morning, church.
Good morning.
I am very happy to be here today, and I trust that you will be more and more as we lean into God's Word and listen to what God says and what He has for us. Whatever your future is, whatever questions you have pertaining to what's next, you know, we say that to each other. It's easy to say, hey, what's next? Or next steps, or that kind of thing. I even have a book just called Next. That all sounds so good, and it sort of has a future thing. But because you know someone, in this case, Jesus, next is no big deal. Next is gonna happen with Him in charge. And today we're going to talk about that. But I want to ask a question first. And I should tell you this on the front end, that 100% of the questions I ask you, I've asked myself. Okay, it's a little Ezra 7, verse 10, which says, Ezra studied the word, then he processed it and applied it to his life before he went public with it and shared it with others. So you got that promise from me. But I've asked this question all week long and even before: what is it that motivates or inspires or sustains you on a daily basis? I want you to think about that right now. This is not it's rhetorical, so don't go shouting your answer. We'll never get out of here. But think about my question. What is it that motivates, inspires, and sustains you on an almost daily basis? Is it something or someone that you're thinking about right now? Now, what is that? You got note pages, write that down. Just whatever it happens to be that popped into your mind, this motivates, this inspires, and honestly, sustains means when things are hard, this keeps you taking the next step, okay? That's what I mean by sustains you. Now, before I go any further, let me just put out a fact. Let me just sort of lay this out right now. It's the inferred answer, obviously, is God, right? I mean, put it together. We're in church. I'm preaching a message. The right answer? God. Okay? Okay, you with me? And I'm not being cute. I just mean that's obviously the right answer. I mean, all of those things come together. But I thought, okay, don't be flippant, Steve, because I thought this. My answer was, well, God, you're what inspires, you're what sustains me, you're motivating me, you do it. Give me another question. And then I got to thinking, well, wait a minute. There's other things too. And so I want to share with you my list, just to put me out there a little bit, okay? So the first thing on my list, and it didn't take me any time to think about this, is my wife and my children. Debbie and 3 kids. They motivate me, they inspire me, they sustain me. They've been with me in hurricanes and floods and disasters, just like Isaiah 43 talks about. But they've been there for me. And that's very inspiring for me. And that makes me want to be a good husband and a good dad. Here's the deal. They're incredible people, so they're going to put up with whatever I give. Right? My wife just rolled her eyes, so... Should have put a note in my, put a statement. Don't look at Debbie at this point, but that'll. So, but here's the deal: they're persevering people. They'll put up with a lot, but you know what? I don't let them put up with a lot most of the time. I'm motivated. Remember, I'm inspired. I'm sustained by them. I want to tell you something. I don't want them to settle for just any old Steve. I want them to be thrilled. I want them to be satisfied customers, if you want to put it in those terms. With me? Okay, I got a second one. Ready? Okay, the second thing that sustains me or inspires and motivates me is pride of effort and or achievement. Okay? This explains why I work hard. The word wing it, The core word wing, is a 4-letter word to this pastor. I'm not that guy. I swing for the fence every week. I live in a, probably thanks to my dad and Swindoll, they both sort of said a version of this, don't bore people. You know, you've got God's word, it's the most exciting thing you could possibly share with people. Don't cause people to doze off. So here's the deal, here's the deal. If I kind of live with this sense that somebody's going to leave church and they're going to say, man, that sermon, oh, it was a sleeper, right? That would, so here's the deal. Would you make this commitment? If you fall asleep today, have a good nap, but don't ever tell me about it, okay? I'll assume you've got a medical need that requires sleep in church at precisely the time I'm preaching, okay? So we'll just go that, all right? So that's the second. But here's the third, and this is a little bit of me putting myself out with the potential of misunderstanding. What motivates me, inspires me? Money. Hold on to your wallet, men. Close your purse, ladies, you know, right? Money. Does that surprise you? To hear a pastor say money? Some of you are even shocked. Wow, money motivated? Didn't the Bible say, you know, not for sordid gain? 1 Peter 5 or something like that? But here's the deal. Don't be shocked, all right? I am well aware and therefore very careful that about money, because money can become a problem for any of us, but it can especially be costly to the soul, which is too big a risk for any of us as well. So says 1 Timothy 6, and that whole section is one of my favorite go-to passages to remind me, don't let money get out of hand. Don't make it a big deal. It is a motivator. Y'all want to know why I come to work? Okay, some of you are going, isn't it just to love the people? Yeah, and I get paid to do that. I love what somebody asked me recently. Part of our family promise group, they asked me recently, hey, is it true you guys, your preachers only work on Sundays? And I said, yes. Pretty good gig, wouldn't you say? You know, there it is. For the love of money, this is 1 Timothy 6, verse 10. Love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. This is not just written to pastors. It's to you too. Some people, pastors and others, eager for money, have actually wandered from the faith. I like to say they've gone off the rails. And the consequence? I don't like to finish this verse. It causes somebody to be pierced with many griefs. You know what? No one needs me to define that today. If I say, you want to be happy or filled with grief? How many happy people? How many grief people over here? No, you don't want that. And when it says many griefs, I'll stay far away from that, or try to. So I monitor my money attraction closely, but I'm honest in telling you it motivates me to work when I don't feel healthy and work when my heart's heavy, to show up, to be sustained. I got to feed my family. What's wrong with that? It's right in the Bible. I remember a guy back when I was training for ministry in Southern Cal and in my seminary work, and grad work is hard, and like a lot of you know. And then I worked at a grocery warehouse, the Vons Company. And I loved that job. And most people didn't speak English there, but I just loved rubbing shoulders with all these. We were just bros, you know. And I would always come to work. There's a guy named Victor, and we're pulling our orders in a hot, sweaty warehouse, no air conditioning, you know. But we're making good money. We were union guys. We were making a killing. And as a result, being able to care for our families. And Victor's his name. And I'd come in there and go, hey, bro, how's it going? He goes, working hard, bro, hard. And then he said this, baby needs shoes. That was his answer every time. I thought, man, your child gets a lot of shoes. Seriously. But you get what I mean? Okay, so that's a good, I like that guy. Victor inspired me. So that's my short list. Does that help you with yours? That's what I'm talking about. What it motivates, inspires you, sustains you. Hopefully it does. I also thought very quickly of two fairly famous people and their take on my question. What motivates, inspires, sustains you? The first guy is an American psychologist. He's gone, dead and gone, but his work lives on. Created a hierarchy of needs known as Abraham Maslow. That was his name. And in 1943, he was kind of stirring over this same question. And it resulted in him writing on a paper called The Theory of Motivation. So he was trying to go, what is gas in your tank, in your tank, in your tank? What motivates you? And I won't go into detail, but what stands out to me is that he in the bottom level of this pyramid, it looks like a pyramid, look it up, and the bottom level is physical needs met. So people will do a lot every day for food, for a roof over their head, shelter, for clothes over their body. That motivates at a very base level, Maslow says. And in fact, it's the stuff of survival which gets us out of bed and gets us going. It's like rocket fuel for most of us. That's a voice from last century. Here's a guy that's still doing his thing. I've never been to one of his things, but he's pretty famous out there. Tony Robbins. Name sound familiar? Some of you have even gone to one of his motivational seminars. He's a sort of a self-help guru, very motivational in his... But he wrote about what motivates. And that's kind of at a core. He addresses that question. And he concludes that human beings are motivated by, I love this, the desire to meet six core needs. You don't even have to know the six. I'm going to tell you the top one on his list. The top of his list of motivating needs is certainty. Would you write that down? Because that's what God's going to speak to and reveal in this psalm. Humans crave certainty. I'm slowing down so you can write these words that are typically wrapped up in this idea of certainty, which we crave. Ready? Okay, so make this list on the pages of your notes. It's the stuff that, it's wrapped with stuff like safety. Certainty comes with stability. And we like security. Some of you buy an alarm system at home, partly for that. There's more. Comfort. What goes with certainty is stuff like order and predictability. Here's one, and it's not all bad. Control. You want to be in control. The person you're driving with is a lousy driver. Why do you want to say, pull over, I'll take it from here? Because you want control, and it's an okay thing. And consistency is part of this certainty thing. Most of us like every one of those things. I do. Another self-disclosure moment. Unfortunately, many, many of them are out of our control. That's amen from the mouth of a babe right there. Think about it. Think about what I just said, the stuff of comfort and order and predictability and control and all of that stuff. With no warning, they can vanish through stuff like accidents, illness. You think you got good grip on life and then an economic catastrophe happens. Job loss. Ask the folks that live south of southern Oregon. Earthquakes. California will tell you, I saw a man interviewed in this last upheaval of 7-point earthquakes, and he says, you know, I came here because it was just a great place, and I just felt so like good being here. And he goes, he just rattled. And he goes, I don't think I can retire here. The guy's like move? And he goes, yeah, I'm out. I can't. So certainty took a hit that day for that man. It would for many of us. Things like drought or famine undermine certainty. You get the idea, don't you? That certainty, which Robbins touts as foundational, you ready for this? Is anything but certain. And the Bible plainly acknowledges everything I've just said. Psalm 46 makes a great statement at the beginning that God is our refuge and our strength, our ever-present help in times of trouble. That's certain. And then the very next verse, he goes into the stuff that's not, the rest of life as we know it. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth gives way. I don't know what that looks like, but I pray that Mount Hood stays here my whole life. I don't want that's such a nice thing, and if it goes, I go. But anyway, though the earth gives way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging, and the psalm ends with verse 7, the Lord Almighty, in spite of all that, is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Great word. In the face of uncertainty, God is present, God is powerful, and God is personal. He alone, listen people, he alone is certain. Can I get an amen? Okay, all right. Now we're ready, all right? We're ready to embrace the song that we're going to sing in just a moment. It's a song that's supercharged with help and hope, the series for the summer. It will have that effect on Jesus lovers. I can't say for certain what it'll do if you don't know Jesus. Are you hearing the not so subtle appeal? Let's make a move here. If you've been coming to church and hearing great worship and not falling asleep in sermons, then realize there's something more. There's something behind all that. It's Jesus. So this song that I want to share with you now is for Jesus lovers who live in a world weary of uncertainty. Okay? So the song is Because He Lives. It's a song that was composed by prolific songwriters, Bill, a husband and wife team, Bill and Gloria Gaither. They're in their late 70s now. This is one of more than 700 collaborations. 700. It's like they wrote songs all the time. And every song, as songwriters have told me, has a story. So, what's the story? I think, by the way, this is a favorite of many, and many of you that requested it, because it is timeless. Our world is changing. It's very uncertain. But Because He Lives has implications. So, as you can imagine, Bill and Gloria Gaither, have been asked by many over the years. The song was written in the 70s, actually 1971. They've been asked again and again, what's the backstory? How did this song come to you? In their own words, Because He Lives was written in the midst of social upheaval, threats of war, and betrayals of national and personal trust. If I didn't already tell you that was 1971, what am I describing, y'all? By the way, it's hotter than I'm comfortable. So if somebody knows the way to the cool down button, press it, please. Press it. So back to the quote. He's telling about the story. Because he lives, it was into that world at such a time as that that we were bringing our third child, a little baby. Assassinations, drug trafficking, and war monopolized the headlines. It was in the midst of this kind of uncertainty that the assurance of the risen Christ blew across our troubled hearts like a cooling breeze in a dry desert. As we held our tiny son in our arms, we were able to write, and we'll sing in a moment, how sweet to hold our newborn baby and feel the pride and joy he or she gives. But greater still, the calm assurance. This child can face uncertain days because he lives. Man, what a huge statement by parents in a vulnerable moment, like we just shared in this morning. Because he lives, our child can face a future. Uncertainty, meet your match. Because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. Because I know he holds the future. So life is worth living just because he lives. Wishful thinking or biblical teaching? Let's browse just in the next few minutes the Bible and biblical footing beneath that song. Statements from the Bible that answer the question. Let me have you write this down first. Jesus' words inspired that song. The words of Jesus inspired that song. During his last night, Jesus was with his 11 disciples. You know what happened then, as it's been referred to as the upper room time with the disciples. They were sharing Passover, and from that grew communion and the significance of bread and wine and what those represent. Jesus said, share these things frequently until I return. And he was reminding his men at that time. There were only 11. John 11 tells us this story. There were only 11 of them. Judas had already left earlier in the evening. And Jesus then reveals that he would soon depart. They're having a great time. Passover was a joyful occasion. And he dropped the bomb. Guys, I'm going away. He said it this way, John 14, verse 19. You'll see the connection to the song now. Before long, the world will not see me, Jesus' words. They will not see me anymore, but you will see me. And here's why. Because I live, you will also live. John 14, verse 19. A few days later, Jesus' words proved true. This was Thursday night when he said that to his men. Hours later, he left, went across the Kidron Valley to the Mount of Olives, and sweated tears of blood in the anguish of his aloneness. By the next morning, he had been arrested, and by midday, he was on a cross. Because I live, were his lingering words, you will live also. Three days later, John 20 reports that those words were fulfilled. On the evening of that first day, which happened to be Easter Sunday, that we know it as Easter Sunday, when Jesus rose from the dead, on the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." We could go a long time with why he said that, but you say that to people that are freaked out, right? Guys, don't sweat. Shh, peace. Stay calm. Peace be with you. And after that, look what he says. He shows them his hands and his side, and the disciples, we're told, were overjoyed when they saw Jesus. If you've ever been there, you know how wonderful words that were spoken earlier are when they come true. Somebody makes a promise to you, and then they come through, and just as they said, And it's just like over the moon stuff. I want you to imagine now for a few minutes if you had been there that night, Sunday night, Jesus is alive and he says peace, and then the text says they were overjoyed. It's really him. I remember what he said 3 days ago. I got a, you know, no problem remembering. It was a great moment. And if you had been there, you would have a fresh memory of Jesus saying that night. Because I live, you will live also. But you would likely also be reliving a miracle. It wasn't too much earlier. And it's told in John 11. So would you turn to John 11 for a few moments? And let me show you this miracle that takes place. And I want you to imagine you're actually there watching it happen, okay? Because it probably would have been on your mind, because it goes back to something that Jesus said about his identity. It was a story a few weeks back, and now here you are in the presence of someone that died in your eye before your eyes, and now he's alive. And you see all of that. And you probably would have remembered this time when Jesus raised Lazarus, John 11, from the dead. Let's imagine that you were there. So a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha, which was about 2 miles outside of Jerusalem. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick," which tells us about their friendship. They were very close. Jesus was not just close with Mary and her sister Martha, but also their brother Lazarus. "The one you love," we're told, "is sick." And you remember that scene if you were there on Sunday morning. You remember Jesus in that moment, instead of being alarmed. He's just heard news that somebody's gonna die if you don't move quickly. And you're studying him, and you notice something that it appears to you it's no big deal to him. I mean, Jesus is like, hey, no big deal, no problem. Verse 4, "This sickness will not end in death." No, it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. So you're hearing this, and you're thinking to yourself, why so dismissive? If I get news somebody's, you know, not feeling well, I jump into action. But in this case, Jesus doesn't. Let me read on. "The sickness is not going to end in death. It's for God's glory." Verse 5, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. You've got a puzzling impression for me. Then he said to his disciples, okay, let's go back to Judea. And when you arrive, as you begin to move that direction, it's as you would guess. There's a lot of commotion. There's sadness and sorrow and wailing that the story goes on to tell. And Martha, one of Lazarus' 6 sisters, comes to Jesus. She's the first to come out of the house and make her way with a purpose to Jesus, because she's got something to say. And when she finds Jesus, she says it. Drop down to verse 17. Let's pick up there. "On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha, Mary, and came to comfort them in the loss of their brother." So they're grieving. "When Martha heard Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home." She is vexed, Martha is. And I get that from what we read next. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you'd been here, my brother would still be alive. He would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." "I know that," came her quick response. "I know that's going to happen again on the resurrection on the day." "No, no, no," Jesus said. "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? He asked her, Martha. That's who's being asked that question. But if you were there, you would have thought to yourself, I kind of get the feeling that's a question I need to answer. It's not just for her. Do I believe this? New Living Translation says it this way. It's kind of a little bit of a twist, but it intensifies it. Anyone who believes in me will live even after dying, and everyone who lives and believes in me will never, ever die. Do you believe this? You didn't answer. It's not recorded here, but you thought of your answer. Wow. Who says stuff like that? Would have been on your mind. Well, I tell you, Jesus, the resurrection and the life, that's who. He's the same one who inspired the chorus to this song, because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone, because I know he holds something no one else can hold, the future. That makes life worth living, because he lives, right? Okay, so what motivates you? You have your answer? Is it God that you would say, if I handed you a mic right now, it doesn't matter what the future holds, my faith is settled in who holds my future? Do you get that? Doesn't matter what the future holds, my faith is settled in the one who holds the future. To the point of singing, because he lives, I can face tomorrow. There's no more obvious application point that I could draw your attention to. The fact is, I will tell you from experience, if you decide that that's how you're going to live it from here, how you're going to go out today and practice what you heard preached by the guy that didn't hopefully put you to sleep, because he lives, I can face whatever tomorrow has. I promise you this, that will be tested. Which takes me to my last point. This would be an incomplete sermon if I didn't mention the man Job. You don't even need to turn there. He's someone whose situation, for a righteous guy especially, was horrible, and his future anything but certain. Job is remembered as a man in the Bible. A whole book bears his name. 42 chapters long, and by the second chapter of his story, he had lost everything that mattered to him. Everything. His children, he had lost his servants, his livestock, his herdsmen, and his home was in rubble. I think that covers everything that's on my list of things that matter. Throw in a further misery when he had an outbreak from head to toe of boils. I looked up boils this week. I don't know what they look like. Don't go there. It's horrible. It's bad. So he's got this boil. Amidst this epic suffering, Job is silent. Even when enticed by his wife to curse God and call it quits in chapter 2, he refuses to relent. Why? Everything fell apart. The bottom fell out. Please hear me now. Job did not know chapter 42. He did not know how it would turn out, that the way you and I can easily flip to 42 and we're there. He did not know that. He had no way of knowing that. Yet he revealed the source of his secret strength to face tomorrow in these words in chapter 19. If you're doing the math, this is the end of the third quarter for him. He said, chapter 19, 25, I know that my Redeemer lives and that in the end He will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. Do you hear resurrection there? I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns for that within me. Job reveals the source of his confidence and certainty. And that, folks, is what sustained and motivated and empowered him to face whatever tomorrow might bring. Will you please bow your heads with me as we prepare to sing this song and wrap up our time together? Way before Jesus spoke the motivating and life-giving words that we thought about this morning, Job shows an extraordinary faith in a God who lives and holds his future. You and me, can affirm like Job that we will see God and we will be able to face whatever tomorrow might bring just because he lives. Amen. Sing it like your soul believes it.